Hello, and welcome to Mail Call, a podcast of newsletters and stories from the Great War. This episode takes a closer look at women's contributions to the war efforts. The war opened more opportunities for women, even before the U.S. officially entered the war in 1917. Although many men disapproved of women's work, there were also some powerful men who supported roles for women, such as Secretary of the Navy Joseph Daniels and General John J. Pershing. Women participated as doctors and nurses, as well as organizing numerous activities on the home front, both in support of the war effort and in support of peace. We begin with some updates on the women's suffrage movement. From the Ardmore Chronicle, one of the first women's voters' manuals, published in 1918.
By exact vote needed to adopt resolution, 274 for, 136 against. Must now run the Senate gauntlet. Women count on president's influence to overcome opposition. Washington. Woman suffrage by federal constitutional amendment won in the House with exactly the required number of affirmative votes. While members in their seats and throngs in the galleries waited with interest, the House adopted, by a vote of 274 to 136, providing for submission to the states of the so-called Susan B. Anthony Amendment for National Enfranchisement of Women. But for the promise of Speaker Clark to cast his vote from the chair for the resolution if it was needed, the change of a single vote to the opposition would have meant defeat. Republican leader Mann, who came from a Baltimore hospital where he has been under treatment ever since Congress convened, and Representative Sims of Tennessee, just out of a sickbed and hardly able to walk to his seat, brought the votes which settled the issue. The House had hardly adjourned before the suffrage champions began their fight for favorable action on the Senate side of the Capitol. Recent polls there have indicated that the necessary two-thirds vote could not be mustered, but encouraged by the House victory and counting on the influence of President Wilson, who came to their support, the suffragists hope to bring the Senate into line so as to have the amendment before state legislatures during the coming year. They feel sure at least of forcing a vote in the Senate before the present session ends. Advocates of the amendment had been supremely confident of the result in the House after President Wilson advised members who called upon him to support it. They were so confident that the close vote was received with amazement, and some of the opponents were almost as much surprised. When the first call was finished, unofficial counts put the result in doubt, and before the speaker could make an announcement, there was a demand for a recapitulation. The name of each member and the way he was recorded was read. Announcement of the vote was greeted with wild applause and cheering. The women in the galleries literally fell upon each other's necks, kissing and embracing and shouting, "Glory, glory, hallelujah!" The resolution was adopted as follows. Joint resolution proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, extending the right of suffrage to women. Resolved by the Senate and House, etc. Two-thirds of each House concurring therein that the following article be proposed to the legislatures of the following states as an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which, when ratified by three-fourths of said legislatures, shall be valid as part of the Constitution. Section 1. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. Section 2. Congress shall have power, by appropriate legislation, to enforce the provisions of this article. Of the total membership of 435, there were 410 members who voted. Their lineup follows. For the resolution, Democrats, 104. Republicans, 165. Miscellaneous, 5. Total, 274. Against the resolution, Democrats, 102. Republicans, 33. Progressive, 1. Total, 136.
The Vote and the Voter by Carrie Chapman Catt, President of the National American Woman Suffrage Association and of the International Woman Suffrage Alliance. Of the more than 27 million women of voting age in the United States, more than one-third are now enfranchised, either as voters for presidential electors or as fully as our present national laws permit women to be enfranchised. No woman in the United States is yet enfranchised as is her husband or her father or her son or her brother, and will not be until woman suffrage is incorporated in the national constitution. Not even then. Unless she can come to hold her naturalization in her own person, instead of as a cloak to be put on and off as she marries, unmarries, or is widowed. Whatever the voting strength of these more than 900,000 women of voting age may be, the fact of practical value for such a book as the present one is that a large and ever-increasing number of women citizen are avid for information on the new questions of local, state, and national government, which women and men must now decide together. They are coming up to these questions with a vivid new personal interest that bids fair to lift civil government out of the cold aloofness of academic discussion on the one side and the mire of politics on the other. To be bromidic, women are going to humanize questions of government. That will not be, I think, because only to woman is given the human outlook on life, but because the human is composite of men and women, and the human and the outlook of both is stirred and developed through cooperative rather than segregated work. As emergent voters, the women of America today are facing the same fundamental questions as to the new responsibility, as are the young American man of 21 and the immigrant. The enfranchisement of woman, the coming of age of the young man, and the naturalization of the immigrant. There you have the three agencies through which the electorate of America is to be kept in a state of inquiry and action, instead of in a condition of acquiescence and being. A prime difference in the three cases is that the woman is asking all the questions that the other two ought to ask, but do not. Of course, it would be the woman who would ask the questions. For one thing, it does not go so hard with women to admit their ignorance as it does with men. For another, woman has had to fight for suffrage, while the young man was acquiring it as he acquired his mustache by the simple expedient of getting older, and the immigrant man was acquiring it by the simple expedient of living in America long enough to take on some of those American ideals and commitments into which the woman, if native, was born, and having fought for the suffrage, the fight has informed woman with a special sense of the value in the thing fought for, and a special desire fully to understand it. Suffragists alone would start the questions, but it is not suffragists alone among women who want the answers. The antis mean to vote. The indifferent mean to vote. In the result, texts on civil government become at one leap of intimate value. Instead of remote summaries of the function of the judiciary, the legislative, the administrative, that of which they treat is identified as breakfast table talk, the mayor's appointments, home rule for cities, what the legislature is doing with the child labor bill, what Washington will do with bills defining the authority of the government and its war control of this, that, or the other. There is an acute recognition of the government as a matter of close contact and an immediate intention to understand it better. And conversely, from now on, thanks to woman's enfranchisement, achieved or impending, it will be necessary for the government to understand woman better, so that the give and take, the reflex from woman suffrage into the body politic and out again upon the community may be better assimilated. When the World War began shaking the existing ideas of government about, it had the effect upon them that is produced by shaking a barrel of apples. The little ones went to the bottom and the big ones came to the top. Consider some of the first little apples to go out of sight. In Italy and in France, women had distinct civil disabilities, such as the necessity of getting their husband's authorization before they could act in legal matters. These ideas have not only sunk to the bottom of the barrel, but have apparently shrunk to a size which has permitted them to fall through the cracks and disappear. In a cataclysm which has destroyed class distinctions by demanding leadership from all classes, sex discrimination could no longer endure in the light of the complete sacrifice for service shown by both sexes. In Italy and France, municipal suffrage is in process of establishment. It is urged by statesmen as much as by women suffragists. In France, it is indeed a necessity, since in many communities, the only people left to protect the standards of life are loyal women who have served their country no less ably than the frontline soldiers who have given their lives for France. The fiercest opponents of woman suffrage in England have demonstrated no little ingenuity in their lightning changes from adamantine hostility to suffrage to fervent acceptance of it. Democracy has become a password. Every state paper and suggested basis of peace drives home, as with bayonet thrusts, the basic fact that for the word democracy, one may now substitute the phrase, government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed. Outside of Germany, it would be hard to find a statesman with the temerity to gainsay this. Up to date, Germany is the only great country which has failed to grasp the fact that this is the real issue of the war. Outside of Germany, there are few political leaders, and those few mainly men advanced in years, who do not now know that women are among the governed. By its recent franchise reform bill, Hungary has demonstrated that the two vital issues, government by the people and the women are people, are recognized as fundamental to the life of that nation.
Next up, we have several articles on the many types of work in which women participated. We'll start with the Ardmore Chronicle, February and March 1918.
Mainline women who have won the title for the highest efficiency in organizing and operating the many measures that have been adopted by the government in various departments of war relief have scored the highest points in having planned and perfected a system which is said to be the greatest aid in turning out rapidly sewed garments that is yet to be adopted. The plan originated with Miss Grenville Dodge Montgomery of Wynwood, who was the most indefatigable worker in all the war measures launched and worked out to great success by the mainline committees. The story of her latest achievement is told by Constance Drexel in an article published in the Public Ledger, which follows. Do we like them? Well, rather, they're heaps of fun to run. You press your foot, 2 feet or gas, and off she goes with the most exhilarating sound of getting these in no time. This is not an automobile, but one of the 50 powered machines just installed at the Red Cross factory, 1315 Market Street, and the enthusiasm is voiced by the women who are going to make garments for the refugees 10 times faster than they ever did before. Why, we're just crazy about running those fascinating things and seeing how fast we can turn out the garments. This novel idea of adopting factory methods is a scheme largely worked out by Miss Grenville Dodge Montgomery, who was busy registering names of volunteer workers all day yesterday at the new Red Cross factory. How did this idea occur to me? In comparing the work turned out down in our Red Cross workrooms by hand and hand sewing machines with the work turned out under modern factory methods, she said. Mrs. Montgomery of Wynwood, as director of the Mainline Emergency Aid Branch and the Mainline Red Cross, one day was called upon for 600 Red Cross aprons, which were to be ordered from a factory. Why can't we women work as they do in those factories? She asked, and probably visited some of those money workshops in Philadelphia, where men and women were making thousands and thousands of waists and dresses so efficiently by powered machinery. She herself tried to run a machine and found that any woman having run any machine, anything from a common sewing machine to an automobile, could easily do it. She found David Kirschbaum of A.B. Kirschbaum and George W. Haney of Haney, Nutter, and Grob more than willing to help her establish a real factory, where volunteer workers could make refugee garments. Almost as quickly as if a magic wand was waved, quarters were contributed, garment manufacturers and makers of power machines donated equipment, and now Philadelphia is starting an experiment which may be adopted in other cities to replace old-fashioned methods. Why, the present methods of the Red Cross workrooms date back to the Civil War, says Mrs. Montgomery. She came, she saw, she conquered with her idea, and now there's an 80-foot table specially built for the cutting machine almost as easily as snapping one's fingers. Then there are sleeve fellers, button holers, button sewers, plain sewers, all to be run by electricity. They will be used to turn out garments for the refugees and civilian populations of our allies and will be cut from the directions given out by the Red Cross in Washington. Mr. Haney, who was there yesterday supervising the installation of some of his machinery, says he expects the woman will turn out anywhere from 6 to 10 times as much work as they did by older methods. But, he added, and Mr. Kirschbaum, another manufacturer of garments, agrees with him, I think this experiment has even broader possibilities. So, the last fortnight, many of the leisure class have been visiting our factories to learn how these machines are run by our operators. This new intercourse is going to make those girls and women see that a factory running machines are not so bad after all. And also, when the girls in those trades see those women they consider real ladies running the machines and liking them too, they will not think their lot so bad. When women begin Monday to work on the machines, there will be 4 men from various shops to teach them, although some of the women have already been talked. Whether they will really not be dressed in bloomers is not decided. The most fetching costume has been decided for this volunteer factory, topped with a bewitching little cap to cover their hair. The bloomers were not designed to be merely fetching, but to protect from the possibility of catching skirts in the machinery. Among the women who have already promised to devote stipulated hours of service each week are Mrs. Charles Harriman of Ardmore, Mrs. H. D. Rossier of Winwood, Mrs. Charles Carver, Jr. of Ardmore, Miss Anna Walthour, 1814 Delancey Street, Mrs. Natalie Claudwell, Mrs. Lewis A. Rommel, Mrs. Charles Leadham, Mrs. Francis J. Dever, Mrs. M. H. Irving, and Mrs. G. S. Briggs. Mrs. James Newland, sister of Admiral Sims, who has been learning how in a factory, will act as one of the supervisors. All the work will be turned over to the Southeastern Pennsylvania chapter of the Red Cross. They wanted to run the factory in shifts of 3 hours each, one in the morning and one in the afternoon, but it is also probable that the machines will be running in the evening, as numbers of real operators employed during the day have said that they, too, wanted to help in this war measure. Everyone is welcome to apply for the service daily. The Volunteer Factory Service Committee would organize the work includes Mrs. J. Willis Martin, Mrs. James Newland, Mrs. Barclay Warburton, Mrs. Reed Morgan, Mrs. Joseph N. Snellenberg, Mrs. Granville Dodge Montgomery, Mrs. David Kirschbaum, Mrs. Samuel Litt, Mrs. Carlton Yarnall, Mrs. George Wharton Pepper, Mrs. E.T. Stotesbury, Mrs. Ellis Gimble, Mr. Carlton Yarnall, Mr. George Wall, and David Kirschbaum.
Women of Interior Department Doing Big War Work. Washington. Under the daily personal direction of Mrs. Franklin K. Lane, wife of the Secretary of the Interior, nearly 500,000 women of the Interior Department are using every spare minute sewing, knitting, and packing things which will comfort and cheer sick and wounded American soldiers in France. When the office day ends, they hurry from all parts of official Washington to the rooms in Secretary Lane's big building, where the Interior Department War Work Association is in continuous session, to turn in finished work and get material for more sweaters, sheets, towels, pajamas, stockings, slippers, and the other articles which are packed in big shipping cases, one of which has gone to Neuilly, France every 10 days. The Interior Department War Work Association is an auxiliary of the American Red Cross. It had its beginnings almost immediately after war with Germany was declared, when the Home Club, which is a social organization of the department with nearly 1,000 members, began planning for relief work. For a time, the association met in the Home Club building on Jackson Place, and in the early days of the movement, its output was distributed through the American-French Clearinghouse. The men of the service are back of the women with their money. Thousands of dollars have been pledged and paid, and the enthusiasm in the good cause has been so practical in its nature, though the work is only just beyond the stake of initial organization.
Mothers-to-be should read Mrs. Moynihan's letter, published by her permission. Mitchell, Indiana. Lydia E. Pinkham's vegetable compound helped me so much during the time I was looking forward to the coming of my little one that I am recommending it to other expectant mothers. Before taking it, I suffered with neuralgia so badly that I thought I could not live. But after taking 3 bottles of Lydia E. Pinkham's vegetable compound, I was entirely relieved of neuralgia. I had gained in strength and was able to go around and do all my housework. My baby, when 7 months old, weighed 19 pounds, and I feel better than I have for a long time. I never had any medicine do me so much good. Mrs. Pearl Monahan, Mitchell, Indiana. Good health during maternity is a most important factor to both mother and child, and many letters have been received by the Lydia E. Pinkham Medicine Company, Lynn, Massachusetts, telling of health restored during this trying period by the use of Lydia E. Pinkham's vegetable compound.
American women, no slackers. We can be well proud of our American girls and women. In France and England, women are taking up the work of men resolutely and have shown their ability to do almost all kinds of work. When it becomes necessary, women will show their worth in countless shops, stores, factories, and offices. No one hears them complain of their hard work. These are the days when American men have come to respect, love, and honor their mothers, wives, and sisters. If a woman is borne down by the weaknesses and suffering of womankind, she should be helped by an herbal tonic made with glycerin, which has had such uniform success during the past half century. She should be well instead of sick and suffering, healthy and vigorous instead of worn out and weak, bright-eyed, clear skin, rosy cheeks. You wouldn't think it was the same woman and it's all due to the use of a few bottles of Dr. Pierce's favorite prescription. All druggists, tablet or liquid, tablets 60C. What this medicine has done for thousands of delicate women, it will do for you. If you're overworked and debilitated, it will build you up. If you're borne down with chronic aches, pains, and weaknesses peculiar to your sex, it relieves and cures. It regulates and promotes the proper functions of womanhood. This old and tried prescription of Dr. Pierce's invigorates the system, purifies the blood, improves digestion, and restores health, flesh, and strength. Consult the specialist at Dr. Pierce's Invalids Hospital, Buffalo, New York, for free confidential medical advice or for a free book on women's diseases.
Girls juggle station baggage in the capital city. The newest thing to come to light in the invasion of a man's province in Washington is a flock of girl baggage masters at Union Station. For 6 months, they have thrived in their new atmosphere, unnoticed and unsung. Each girl handles daily as many as 160 pieces of baggage. During rush seasons, they lift 200 pieces per day. Punching the checks, sending the suitcases down the chute, they declare is the most thrilling part of the work. Lots of muscle and a sweet disposition are the necessary qualities. Miss Gracie Whitty and Mrs. Mary L. and Ethel Simpson act as spokesmen for the group of 12 girls. "Do we like our work?" they answered. "We're just crazy about it. My whole heart is in my work," said Mrs. Whitty. "It is really fascinating. We get lots of knocks, but we don't mind it much. We can't take care of ourselves. The girls wear uniforms on the line of the messenger uniform. They are dark blue and set off with a regular messenger cap. Miss Mary Simpson holds the record for muscle achievement. I carried a trunk that the porter couldn't even get out of the taxi," she said. "What is the first thing you do when you come to work in the morning?" the girls were asked. "Oh, no, we don't powder our noses first. We put on our uniforms," they replied. Standing behind the counter of the baggage room, they look very much like steamship pilots with their blue uniforms and seafaring caps.
Next, we'll take you a short way across the country to Chicago, to what was printed in the Chicago Ledger, April 20th, 1918.
What about the farmerettes? Young farmerettes and pretty drowserettes may make an attractive picture, but they would be of little value in stacking alfalfa or helping thrash wheat, according to Professor H.C. Philly of the University of Nebraska. He seems to believe that women will not be a great factor in solving the question of farm labor, and goes on to point out his reasons for this belief. The typical woman, he tells us, is as busy as she can be without assuming any new duties. She not only keeps the house and rears a family, but usually tends the poultry and assists with the garden. She is a washerwoman, baker, and dairymaid all in one, and has mighty little leisure time to devote to helping out her husband with the other farm work. As for the young city girl, she is neither willing to undertake the farm work, nor would she be physically capable of it, even if she did wish to do it. The life which the average city girl leads is not conducive to hard muscles, and the work of pitching hay would put Miss City Bread in the hospital for a week. High school boys from the cities have been a source of farm labor. Many of these boys do good work and become really efficient hands. The majority, however, have untrained muscles and are ignorant of the simple but necessary things which every 10-year-old farm boy knows. Their first few weeks of farm work are hard, not only for them, but for the men who employ them. Yet, according to Professor Philly, the city can help in sending labor to the farm by releasing the thousands of men in the community who were bred on a farm and are accustomed to heavy work. He believes that these men can be released by the simple expedient of cutting down on unnecessary enterprises and sparing all labor for necessities.
Women's Medical Corps for Service Over There. No less than 250 women physicians and surgeons from every part of the United States gathered in New York City on March 26th at a meeting, the purpose of which was to raise funds to provide medical and surgical treatment for the children in France. It is the intention of the campaign organizers who represent the American Women's Hospitals to establish clinics, dispensaries, and hospitals in France and Serbia, conducted entirely by women. Up to date, more than 50 women physicians, bacteriologists, anesthetists, dentists, radiographers, and lay workers have been sent to these two countries for service under the Red Cross. These women, who are really the advance guard of what is hoped will someday be a great army of women medical workers, have come from all the states in the Union, from the ones farthest west to those in the extreme east, and are working in the common cause. On leaving a certain Atlantic seaport, they sail for France and report at Red Cross headquarters there for further duties or assignments. Dr. Rosalie S. Morton, who heads the organization, said, "If we can get the backing of American women, we can save those babies over there, whose fathers and mothers have been standing off the Hun for the sake of the rest of the world. It is American women doctors' work, and we are asking for the laywomen of this country to put us across."
Some do's and don'ts for knitters. For the benefit of those who are knitting socks for soldiers and sailors, here are a few don'ts and a few do's, which experience has shown are not observed often enough. Don't cast on tightly. In setting up a sock, the casting on should never be done tightly. An otherwise well-knitted sock may become useless by a tight cord at the top, which will finally break from the strain of forcing the foot through. The minimum stretch should be 6¾ inches, and it is wiser to have it stretch 7 or 8 inches. Don't knot your wool. Join the ends by running one end into the other with a darning needle for about 6 inches. Finish off threads on the wrong side by running thread with darning needle through a bias run of stitches in 2 or more opposite directions. Don't make a heel with a seam on the sole. Remember, a man may not have a chance to change his socks for many days, and a lump or knot brings a blister. If the blister breaks, blood poisoning may set in and may result in the loss of a foot or even a life. We cannot afford to lose our men through negligence or ignorance. Don't fail to make the Kitchener toe. This has been proved to be the best toe for men in service. Don't use needles too fine. The knitting should be elastic and loose. If too tightly knitted, the sock becomes hard and felt-like from bad washing and sterilizing. Don't make double heels. Bad washing and sterilizing shrink them in hard, felt-like lump. Don't make a foot less than 10 inches long. The average sizes of 10.5 to 11 are best. Use judgment in making the proportions of the sock size correct, a leg suitable for the size of foot and vice versa. People do not seem to realize that making a sock for a foot size 12 with leg and ankle suitable for a size 9 shows lack of judgment. Don't knit the bands of color into top of sock without first boiling the wool and rinsing. This is to set the color and prevent blood poisoning from color running. One can save much wool by using up the odd bits of contrasting color in this way. The men love it as it helps them match their socks up when washing, and they have a superstition that it is lucky and keeps them from being wounded. Here are the do's. Wash socks before turning them in. This should be done in warm water with Lux or Ivory soap, and the rinsing should be light suds. Ironing is not necessary. Lay them flat on a radiator top and pat into shape, and you will be surprised to find your socks to look 50% better and feel softer. Cast on loosely and count rows so socks will mate when finished. Darn socks lightly at point of gusset. If there is a hole, they are caused by needles not being held tightly together while darning. Also darn lightly any other place if the sock is thin or stitches separate.
Women's Land Army. The Women's Land Army of America, an organization like the one so widespread and successful in England, has been recommended for consideration to the chairman in the New England states by the Women's Committee of the Council of National Defense. It is believed that the plan will work out successfully where the farms are small and agricultural intensive. The plan consists of placing women in units of 10 to 70. These women go out and camp near a large farm or group of farms and hire themselves out for the day or piece work. They are in charge of a housekeeper and 2 or 3 assistants who are taking care of feeding and housing the women. Thus, no extra burden is placed on the farmer's wife. For the most part, these squads of women are put through a 2 or 3 weeks preparatory course in which they acquire an elementary knowledge of implements and the work and become accustomed to the physical strain. Last year, several experiments with squads of this kind were tried in New York State and proved successful, especially for potato planting, fruit pickings, packing, and certain other forms of intensive agricultural work.
Nagging people into patriotism. For once, woman's proclivity to nag has served a worthy purpose, for Miss Alice Marie Lefebvre, domestic at Lindenwood College, Missouri, has succeeded in getting the bakers to obey Uncle Sam's food regulations and like them in the bargain. When Miss Lefebvre first came to St. Charles last September, the work was new to her. She had but recently graduated from the University of Wisconsin, and the new dignity of being domestic director at Lindenwood College sat well upon her. At that time, Lindenwood was busy with the Red Cross work and other patriotic activities, and it was of course expected that the new domestic director would fall in line and be mindful of restrictions on certain kinds of food, advised by the government. Which she was, with a vengeance. No more had Miss Lefebvre arrived than she discovered that the bread in St. Charles was as white and fair and absolutely unchanged as that which had antedated war days. Without thinking much about her administrative duties, she locked her office door and straightaway went out to lecture the bakers of St. Charles on wartime economics. At first, she made little or no impression on the floury men to whom she spoke. They all promised to do better, but none of them made a move to put in the new flour or change their process. Her failure to make an impression the first time, and even the second, did not discourage the solitary patriot. Day after day, week after week, Miss Lefebvre pursued her course. Not content with introducing the new breads and cakes at Lindenwood College, where they soon came to be prime favorites, she continued her uneven battle with the bakers in the entire town. Bakers, who couldn't exactly be rude to a pretty woman, put her off with persiflage, but continued in their own ways. So the uneven battle went on up to Christmas time, the bakers making no effort to change their usual routine. Then they were made to see the light. Professor W.F. Gephardt, chairman of the St. Louis Committee of the U.S. Food Administration, stepped in and forced them to abandon their old methods. And every one of them like it, now. While Miss Lefebvre is happy to think that her pet idea of food conservation is now being carried out all over St. Charles.
Saving War Babies with Jewel Fund. Consuelo, Duchess of Marlborough, an American by birth and an English woman by adoption, has devoted her entire energies to war relief work during the last 3.5 years. Although she has conducted her charities very quietly, attention has been called to them lately by officials of the English government. Since the war began, this American Duchess has raised more than £30,000 for medical work in London, and previous to that, £200,000 for Bedford College for Women. For the gloomy days of Liege and Mons down to the present, she has worked indefatigably for war charities. Through her own efforts, coupled with her generosity, she has created the Children's Jewel Fund in aid of the movement to establish a greater number of maternity and infant welfare centers in the larger cities of England. More than $23,000 has been raised in jewels, and due to her undaunted spirit, this sum bids fair to assume much greater proportions. She has been the moving force in getting the maternity and infant welfare centers organized. In addition, she also has a maternity hospital of her own, looked after entirely by a staff of women physicians. Here, more than 600 babies have been born since the war began, many of them children of Belgian refugees, while others are babies whose fathers are in the trenches. In speaking about women's part in war, she said, "At present, the women whose labor the country must depend on for munition work, for food and for replacing men in all kinds of manual labor, must choose between staying at home and caring for their babies, or going to work, leaving the babies to be cared for by anyone who may happen to undertake to do so, the children very often going without proper care and attention. Money has been given, but money is more difficult to get than ever. We are asking women to give jewels, for there are a few women who will not spare adornments of life to bring health and happiness to a child. We now have 1,150 centers for the care of mothers and babies. We are asking for 5,000 more. It seems a great deal, but we have already had a splendid response, and the American Red Cross has given us £4,000 to establish centers to be known as ARC Maternity and Child Welfare Centers in aid of our large industrial towns. It is splendid what women of the United States have done," she said with enthusiasm. "From the first, they have realized their responsibilities. I knew they would. Like the men of America, they are doing their part with true American spirit, and anyone who knows that spirit knows that they and the entire nation are in the war to win and will be a great big factor in bringing about ultimate victory. The people of the United States have made voluntary sacrifices, which are the real test of patriotism. The food-saving campaign to help the Allies is a splendid demonstration of unselfish organization. They certainly have risen to the occasion."
Courage needed. Miss Lillian Morse, Red Cross organizer, who spoke on a war nurse's life before 50 college women in the home of Mrs. William Mitchell of New York some time ago, dwelt on the courage and physical strength that it required for a woman to go into the battle with soldiers, live beside them, fight with them, and nurse them. Very often, she declared, life for the young women who offered to serve on the battlefields of France would be far from a pleasant one. According to her statements, young women who were going into Red Cross work believed that theirs would be a path of roses, should take heed, and learn of what their duties consisted before they entered the training course. The college women who gathered to hear her speak are those that are planning to take up the work and undergo the training at the Vassar College Summer Training Camp, which will begin shortly. The training at this camp will be intensive, and so arranged that when the young women have completed their course, they will be ready to leave for France. It is said that more than 20,000 women who have taken training in the past and qualified for Red Cross work are needed now to take commands in Europe, and appeals are reaching every Red Cross station throughout the country to enlist all women trained along these lines for active duty.
Your kitchen in wartime. The whole great problem of winning the war rests primarily on one thing: the loyalty and sacrifice of the American people in the matter of food. It is not a government responsibility. It is the responsibility of each individual. Each pound of food saved by each American citizen is a pound given to the support of our army, the Allies, and the friendly neutrals. Each pound wasted or eaten unnecessarily is a pound withheld from them. It is a direct personal obligation on the part of each of us to someone in Europe whom we are bound to help. If we are selfish or even careless, we are disloyal. We are the enemy at home. Now is the hour of our testing. Let us make it the hour of our victory. Victory over ourselves. Victory over the enemy of freedom. Herbert Hoover, United States Food Administrator. No wheat flour needed. The following are some recipes for various dishes calling for no wheat flour. Apple and cornmeal pudding. Scald a quart of milk, add half a cup of cornmeal, cook for half an hour, and add a teaspoonful each of salt and ginger and half a cup of molasses. Bake in a buttered baking dish, stirring constantly for an hour. Then add 2 cups of peeled, cored, and sliced apples, and bake another hour without stirring. Serve with cream or with pudding sauce. Fruit muffins. Cook a cup of cornmeal and 1 cup of milk, to which a teaspoonful of salt has been added, for 5 minutes. Cool and add a teaspoon of baking powder. Beat thoroughly and add a cup of cream and half a cup of raisins and dried currants. Bake in well-greased muffin tins. Boston brown bread. Here is a good recipe for Boston brown bread. Mix thoroughly 2 cups of cornmeal and the same amount of rye flour. Dissolve a teaspoon of soda in 2 tablespoons of boiling water. Add this to 3 cups of sour milk and 1 cup of molasses, and add all the liquids to the meal and flour. Stir well, adding a teaspoon of salt, and pour into a greased mold. This will fill a 2-quart mold. Steam for 5 hours, then take off the cover and the mold and bake for 20 minutes. Corn drops. Pour 1.5 cups of boiling water on 2 cups of cornmeal. Add 1/2 teaspoon of salt and 1/4 cup of butter, or butter substitute. Then add 3 tablespoons of milk and 2 beaten eggs. The eggs and milk should be beaten together until light. Mix well and drop by teaspoonfuls on greased tins. Bake for 20 minutes in quick oven.
Next, we'll hear from the Catholic Standard and Times about what life was like in the trenches of war.
Cry from trenches to nurses echoed. Ideal womanhood outlined by Richard M. Riley, KCSG, at St. Joseph's School. That the cry from the trenches of Europe is for brave women to care for the dying and wounded is the message given to the graduating nurses of St. Joseph's Hospital Training School, Lancaster, PA, by Richard M. Riley, KCSG, at the commencement exercises held last week in the presence of members of the advisory board, the sisters of the institutions, and the parents and friends. Miss Maud E. Broadbecker of Lancaster, Miss Bertha B. Stamen of Lititz, Miss Elsie May Helm of Lancaster, and Miss Ernestine E. Shirk of Lincoln were presented with medals and diplomas. E. Guilford presented at the exercises. The Reverend Henry G. Ludes, chaplain of the hospital, gave the invocation. The opening address by Mr. Riley was most forceful and eloquent, in which he outlined the ideal womanhood. The greetings and presentation of medals were made by the Right Reverend Monsignor Anthony F. Call, P.R. of St. Anthony's Church. The address to the graduates and conferring of diplomas was made by Dr. N. E. Bitzer, Medical Director. The exercises closed with the singing of America by the nurses. Myers' String Orchestra furnished the music. In his stirring address, Mr. Riley said, "It is a very great pleasure for me to be present today, taking a humble part in the graduation exercises of St. Joseph's Hospital Training School for Nurses, and joining in the chorus of praise for the four talented young women who, having finished their course, are now prepared to go out into the world to join the noble band of nurses who are doing vital service for humanity. The occasion gives rise to some reflections upon which we may briefly dwell. And first, it may be observed that never in the history of recorded civilization has the nurse played a more important role than that which enlists her energies today. In this world war, the most ruthless and sanguinary that has ever darkened the pages of history, woman has been given the freest rein for the development of her spirit in idealism, which we all recognize as the most charming trait in her makeup, and which essentially differentiates her from man. Witness the stories from behind the battlefront where woman has risen to the full stature of her nobility of character, binding up the wounds of the suffering, bringing order out of chaos in the frightened civilian population, imperiling her life amid the storm of shot and shell, aye, giving up her life to comfort the dying, a veritable angel of mercy on the battlefield, proving today, as of old, when pain and anguish wring the brow, a ministering angel thou. None but God knows the marvelous instances of individual heroism that are being daily enacted in regions where the courage is greatest, where modest, dark-robed sisters like those good women who here serve under the glorious banner of St. Francis vie with the white-robed Red Cross nurse in their mission of mercy. Like sacrifice and devotion has never been witnessed since the world 4 centuries ago entered upon the experiment of intense selfish individualism which is reaping its harvest of horrors today. It may be a part of the divine plan that a byproduct of the war will be a new social order in which national progress will not be measured in terms of material wealth, when there will be fewer mighty fortunes but more general comfort, a truer proportion between the conditions of rich and poor, less luxury but also less misery. None can observe the widespread interest in Red Cross service and the many other war activities without realizing the vast change in public attitude towards relief measures. The leaders in every community, men and women, are quitting their desks and abandoning their drawing rooms, eager to enlist in the cause of alleviating human misery, and it may be that the awful price we are paying for this war, whether in money or human life, will not be too much if the world turned again to the early Christian period, when the followers of the lowly Nazarene were identified by the saying, "See how these Christians love one another." The vocation of nurse, now so needful in the world's economy, enjoys the happy distinction of beauty and utility in the working out of its functions. Many of us are required to devote ourselves to lives of work that have little or no relation to the higher life. We are constrained at all times to struggle against the coarse materialism that hedges us in, and we need constantly to remind ourselves that our daily tasks are a means, not an end. The nurse, however, has the serene satisfaction that, while making an honorable livelihood, she is bearing a noble part reducing the sum total of human misery. It is essentially a career that stands for personal service. It means the giving of oneself wholly and unreservedly to the task in hand. Just as we know that the giving of money is the least part of charity and can only be considered as charitable insofar as it represents the desire to take the hand of the wayfarer or sufferer for comfort, so a nurse who looks upon her work as simply measured by the money represented in her compensation falls short of the ideals which true nursing involves. She must even remember that what men and women require in this life is oftentimes the sympathetic word, the moral support of human fellowship. It must be borne in mind that nurses often have opportunities for the strengthening of moral purpose, the brightening of cheerless lives, the bringing of comfort to homes of sorrow. This, to be sure, implies a greater sacrifice, a more unselfish spirit, but it stands for the kind of service that will aid in saving the world from crass selfishness and which will infuse into society a grace that has been conspicuous by its absence these many years. Fortunately for the world, and particularly at this juncture, we need have little or no fear that the modern nurse will fall below the high standard that has been set for her. When man is ill, whether he be young or old, he instinctively seeks to be mothered. It is stamped upon our male intelligences that in the sick room woman occupies a place unattainable by any mere man, be he ever so skillful. The cry from the European trenches is ever, "Mother!" And the gentle Abby Flynn told us a few nights ago that the truest priestly function was to be a mother to the brave lads wounded or dying for country. Woman is coming to her own more and more, and rightfully so. But let not the stream of ultra-feminism carry us too far. As Ruskin has well said, woman's equality with man does not involve her identity with him. Her power and dignity are derived as much from that in which she differs from man as from that in which she agrees with him. Her proper power depends upon the maintenance of this difference. It has been well said that woman is by nature the indicator of the moral idea and the nurse of mankind. She is at once judge and physician. Justice and mercy meet in her, and the foundation of her character is devoted to the ideal. Her function is to beckon man ever forward to greater moral achievement, setting no limits to his labor to that end. His part is to fashion the world, hers to maintain the moral standards by which his work is judged. Nay, she must do more. She must assist him in the realization of the ideal which she holds before him. She must strengthen him in his moments of weakness, cheer him in his hours of depression, and aid him by timely counsel and sympathy. I have tried briefly to set forth for your consideration the ideal womanhood to which you should aspire and which you are now about to enter. I need not tell you how earnestly, nay, prayerfully, you will be followed by the good sisters, the self-sacrificing members of the staff, the superintending nurse, and all who contributed to bring about today's event. In addition, may I be permitted to present the felicitations and congratulations of the advisory board of the institution, who hope and believe that an honorable career in the world awaits you.
Now we'll take you across the ocean to a paper published in August 1918 in Paris, France, called The Stars and Stripes.
250 WACs here to relieve men from SOS duty. Women war workers from England will aid in labor plan. First on clerical work, later arrivals will be assigned to other jobs, as Army may decide. 250 English girls have come down from the British front, all over from England, to work for and with the AEF. They constitute a unit of the famous WACs, or WAACs, as the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps of Great Britain was called, until for its good work in many branches of behind-the-lines war endeavor, it was taken under the royal patronage and rechristened Queen Mary's Army Auxiliary Corps. These 250 girls are at present working in the Central Records Office near Tours, under the direction of the Adjutant General's Department. Their duties, save for those of their number that are on their temporary camp's permanent KP and laundry detail, are in the main stenographic and clerical. By September, it is expected that there will be 1,000 WACs in and about Tours, and already ground is being broken and prepared for permanent barracks for them. The bringing over of these English young women as part and parcel of the American military establishment is in line with the AEF policy of employing women in offices and elsewhere wherever they can replace men. The policy of utilizing every able-bodied man in a man's job, as it has been called. In another line, for example, about 4,000 French women are being employed in the big salvage plant not far from the cantonment of the WACs, and thousands of French women and girls are being employed elsewhere. The cantonment of the WACs deserves a bit of mention for its cleanliness, neatness, and general up-to-dateness. It consists of cooksheds, laundry, and a long barracks building, the so-called Swiss barracks, on the same type as those used in hospitals. The fitting up of it, cots and all, is much like that of an American or English hospital. One end of the principal building is set off as a mess shack, with the officers' mess for the 7 women officers in direct charge of the girls, and regulation tables for the members, as the girls are called instead of being dubbed enlisted women, as one might expect. Then there are the officers and the members' quarters, and there the difference between soldiering it as a woman and soldiering it as a man is plainly shown. The WACs, to be sure, have issue blankets, just like the rest of us, no more. They have cots such as we have, only when we are lucky enough to get into a hospital. But where we have issue packs and issue rifles and the like, the WACs have each an issue chair, an issue table, and an issue mirror. Outside their barracks is a neat walk, lined with whitewashed stones and most military in appearance. In fact, the whole life of the little cantonment is run on military lines, with roll calls, regular mess, and lights out hours, and all the other things that go to make army life the formidably perfect thing it is. The WACS's uniform is olive drab in color, to match pretty nearly that of the Yanks and the Tommies, or a rather heavy whipcord, and is in the two ensemble most pleasing to the eye. It is surmounted by a soft brown hat, with a narrow brim all the way around. A jaunty, comfortable-looking kind of hat, it is. For wear out of camp, the WACS have a simple drab coat, with a loose belt similar to that on American officers' raincoats. While there is no strictly regulation shoe, the style most favored is the high and mannish-looking tan. The WACS, as has been said, furnish their own KP, laundry, and other details, all except the guard, which is furnished by an outfit of American engineers in an adjoining camp. And while the engineers know and obey their general orders to the letter, it must be awfully trying at times to live up to the inexorable maxim to talk to no one except in line of duty. The WAAC is a strictly military organization, recruited when Britain first began to realize the need for releasing for active service every man possible. It made its beginning by taking over the bulk of the clerical work for the British Army in France. Later, it branched out into other activities, and now its members are employed as ambulance and automobile drivers, mechanics, gardeners, cooks, and waitresses in officers' and non-coms messes, to mention only a few of the varied jobs which the WACS have held and are holding down well. There are tens of thousands of WACS in France now, and even more at home, working in offices and factories directly concerned with the prosecution of the war. At present, the AEF's plans do not call for the employment of the WACS in other than clerical capacities. There may be a corps of women motor drivers and so forth in the future, but it is not yet in sight. But the big fact is, for the interest of the men at the front and the others who want to get there, that women will be employed in every place practicable behind the lines. The body of 250 WACS workers now with us is in earnest of the intent to follow out that policy.
We'll conclude this episode with an excerpt from the Red Cross Girls in British Trenches, the first in a series of 10 books published from 1916 to 1920. The series follows four American girls who volunteer for service with the Red Cross in Europe. Before traveling to their first assignment, the girls have the opportunity to meet Dr. Louisa Garrett Anderson, a real-life figure who served as the first female army surgeon in Britain.
Chapter 9. But Yet a Woman. Most of the next day, the American Red Cross girls devoted to seeing London. They had visited the Tower and Westminster Abbey and the House of Parliament soon after their arrival. So as the sun was shining with unusual vigor of London, they concluded to spend the greater part of their final time out of the doors. London in late May or early June is a city transformed. During the winter, she is gray and cold and formidable, so that the ordinary American traveler often finds himself antagonistic and depressed. Then the Englishman appears cold and unfriendly as his skies. But let the sun shine and the flowers bloom in the parks, and the spirit of the city and its people changes. Naturally, on the account of the shadow of the war, the Red Cross girls had anticipated an atmosphere of sorrow and gloom over London, but to their utter amazement, on the surface of things, there was no such effect. There were, of course, many families in grief over the passing of one of their dearest, or even more tragic anxiety over the fate of others, either at the front or prisoners of war. But whatever private suffering, there was slight sign of it. No one was wearing mourning. The theaters and restaurants seemed to be doing a good business, and the streets and parks were everywhere crowded. Except the flags of the Allied nations waved from nearly every public building and large shop, and that the taxi cabs carried placards urging men to enlist, and there was little to suggest a nation at war. Yet there was one other cautious sight that which Barbara from the top of the omnibus discovered. Over the roofs of the important government buildings and above many great private houses hung a great flat screen of heavy wiring netting, closely woven. From a distance, it formed a cobweb effect, as though gigantic spiders had been spreading their great webs over London. "I wonder what that means," asked Barbara, pointing upward, and then knew the answer, although she listened politely while Mildred explained. Oh, the wire is to prevent bombs from dropping down on houses when London has her great Zeppelin raid. Father began telling me that London must expect them to occur as soon as the war broke out. Nona, who had been looking pensive, now leaned over from the back seat where she was sitting with Eugenia. I'm not wishing any harm to London, I adore it. But if the Germans are going to send their marvelous army of the air to bombard the city, don't you wish it would happen while we are here? Barbara laughed, and Mildred shook her head, and Eugenia said seriously, Nona, you don't look in the least like a bloodthirsty person. I can't understand you, child. You talk as if you have no sense of fear, and have not been able to make up my mind whether it is because you know nothing of danger, or whether you are different from most women. But remember that we're going to our work tomorrow, and I don't think there will be many of the horrors of this war that we shall be misseeing. I am afraid I am a coward, for I dread a great part of them. But this isn't the hospital that we're looking for. At least it will be a tremendous inspiration to meet the woman who has done more for nursing among British soldiers than any other woman in this war. Dr. Garrett Anderson established the first woman's hospital at the Claridge Hotel in Paris a month after the war broke out, together with Dr. Flora Murray. And the women have done such wonderful surgical work that all the country is talking about them. Barbara whistled softly. So they brought this Dr. Anderson back to London and made her a major, the first woman ever given military rank in the British Army, she exclaimed. When one considers the Englishman believes a woman's place is the home, it's hard to tell how he is going to reconcile what women are doing to help in this war, men's work as well as their own. But I bet you the English won't give the women the vote when the war is over. Just the same. They can go back home then, although a good many of the poor things won't have any homes to go to. Eugenia revealed an annoyed frown. She was going to do her best to find in Barbara Meade. Her New England conscience assured her there must be good in everyone. But so far Barbara's trying qualities were much more conspicuous. I do wish that you would not use slang, Barbara, she urged, almost plaintively. It may be all right in the West, but really, it would give English people such an unfortunate impression of us. Barbara flushed. Of course, she must break herself of this habit. Nevertheless, she would like to have mentioned that she heard a good deal of slang since arriving in England, and although, unlike the American kind, equally amusing. However, as it was now time to dismount from the top of their bus, all required all her energy and intelligence. The meeting with Dr. Louisa Garrett Anderson was necessarily brief, and the distinguished woman, happening to have a single free hour, had consented to meet the new nurses and wish them Godspeed.
That concludes this episode of Mail Call. Historical documents for this episode were accessed through the digital collections of the Digital Library of Villanova University and the Library of Congress. Our theme music is Till We Meet Again, as performed by Nicholas Orlando's Orchestra. The Mail Call podcast is a project of Home Before the Leaves Fall, a Great War centennial exposition. For more information, please visit our website at wwionline.org. This episode featured the voice talents of Beaudry Allen, Gabriella Bernacco, Deborah Bischoff, Gina Duffy, Hunter Hautzer, Laura Huddlemeyer, Damien Katz, Rob LeBlanc, Ruth Martin, Teres Ortinsky, William Repetto, Callie Stahl, David Uspel, Marianne Watson, and Sarah Wingo. I'm your narrator, Chris Hallberg. This episode was edited and produced by Gabriella Bernacco. Our executive producer is Laura Bang. For more episodes or more information, please visit our website at wwionline.org.